You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. In today's episode, Benjamin and myself speak about baseline testing, a widespread but difficult to treat disease. So I'm a big fan of LinkedIn. It's actually pretty much the only social media that I'm using. It gets lots of insight about what's going on in the industry. There's no cat videos and things like that. You can learn a lot about kind of what's going on with the competition, what's going on with regulators, what's going on in terms of the community. So join LinkedIn if you haven't done yet. And if you're on LinkedIn, then please also join the Effective Statistician LinkedIn group, because there you will come together with like-minded people that also listen to this podcast, and you can exchange your ideas and learn from each other. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is just £20 for non-high-income countries and only £95 for the others. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. This time it's again Benjamin and myself. Hi Benjamin, how are you doing?
Thanks Alexander, very well. Just returning from vacation, so could be worse. Well, it could be better.
Yeah, depending on how you look at it. But I really, overall, I enjoy work. So that's it's probably good. But, and sometimes, you know, vacation, then some kind of work in the office can also be quite nice.
That's true. But still, sometimes you need a break. And that's why it's always nice to be somewhere else, especially if it's getting colder here and you go somewhere warm.
Yeah, I can imagine that Italy in fall is quite nice. So
it is indeed.
So we are recording this in October of 2019. And today we are talking about baseline testing for randomized studies. When have you first been confronted with this problem or this topic?
not that often in my career. The reason is that I started usually with non-randomized studies. So I had a lot of interaction with single arm trials, and so there was some investigation quite meaningful into the baseline characteristics. So that's a different topic. So actually in my active life as a statistician, I have not come across this topic at all. I know that there are discussions ongoing, and I know that there are some challenges with it. Let's phrase it this way. But actually, it's not in my active portfolio of statistical misses that I can talk about. So, but actually, I mean, what about you?
Well, I can remember that when I was very fresh in the farmer life and fresh from university and didn't have a lot of ideas about randomized controlled trials and all around that, I was actually quite naively just doing some of these tests at baseline, not thinking a lot about it. And then I remember I was at a meeting in the US, and we were discussing about the table layouts of a phase 3 study, and there were these p-values for each of these baseline tests. And the most senior statistician in the room stepped up and said, "We'll delete all these tests. They are just nonsense." And that's where I first learned about the problems with baseline tests.
Okay. But why did you do it then initially? I mean, hasn't this been specified somewhere and some senior reviewer was tumbling?
No, it was, I think, just because there were two groups, and when there are two groups, what do? You compare them. And you had then the means and the standard deviations and everything described by treatment arm. So just add a p-value, like what you usually do. I didn't really thought so much about it initially, but then he kind of explained why it doesn't make sense. Yeah. So and the very, very easy explanation is we designed this experiment in such a way that at baseline, both treatment groups are the same and any deviation is just random. So at baseline, we know that the null hypothesis is true because we designed it that way. So testing it doesn't make sense because we know the truth. So
yeah. So is it then that people ask for it? I mean, in a way, it must be popular somehow because otherwise it wouldn't be a topic. So what is then the rationale? If it's so easy, so straightforward to say it's nonsense, so why is it done then?
Before we looked into this podcast and prepared the podcast, we looked a little bit into the literature and it's quite striking. If you look first in some literature by Doug Altman from 1985, you already see this problem mentioned and discouraged.
Just to repeat, 1985.
Then, you know, in the early 2000s, people like Stephen Senn even wrote about it and said that it's not useful and actually more harmful than useful. And then we found even a publication that is from 2016, where the authors write, in a quick scan of recent publications in the journal Psychology and Health from 2015 to most recent, I noticed that it's common for RCTs to, and now my
include results in NHSTs.
so of baseline tests, and this tendency seems pervasive throughout the literature. Yeah, and it is. You see it all around. So even after how many? About 35 years of Doug Altman's paper. Now he died and it's still alive. It's kind of, it's really, really a big problem. And, you know, just by the easy example and the easy explanation I just gave, it's pretty obvious that anything needs to be just at random, but still people will ask for it. Yeah. So there will be people that will just be so used to seeing these p-values, they will say, please provide them. And to be honest, these people can come from all kind of different sources. You know, say you may be just unlucky and have even a regulator asking for that or peer reviewer at a journal. And then I think people say, before I actually argue with that and put anything at risk, here it is. And I know from very, very senior statisticians that I had discussions with, they said, I don't care. I don't want to invest time in fighting about that. I'll just give it. I'll think the problem is that if you just have enough baselines or enough studies, one or the other p-value will become significant. Just by chance, yeah. At random, you should have some that, you know, if you test against 5%, about, you know, on average, every 20th p-value should be significant. And what you do about it, yeah? So then you have this p-value, and then you need to even argue about it. And then, you know, you provided it, and then you need to argue about it. That doesn't make sense. But why did you then provide it in the first place? So you get in these rabbit holes of discussing about completely non-relevant things. So today we'll give you a couple of resources that can help you to actually fight back on this.
But how do you then handle the baseline data? I mean, if you don't do the p-value, the p-tests or the testing with differences, how do you incorporate them?
Yeah, just just yourself. I think for me personally, it's more to look into what are the characteristics of the population. Yeah, so it, for me personally, it's not so much of whether the two treatment arms are similar. It's more about what is the overall population of the study. So for me personally, I think, you know, it would be completely sufficient to show, you know, not by treatment groups, but just total. But of course, you want to see ends and a couple of other things. But generally, for me, the baseline characteristic are important for understanding the results overall, for which patient population did you achieve the results, and how is that patient population, for example, different to another clinical trial.
Yeah, and for example, I mean, if you do the randomization, if you plan the randomization, you do adjust for the relevant baseline characteristics anyway.
Exactly.
So if then coming to a conclusion after you've done the randomization correctly, then that somehow, you know, doesn't make sense. Absolutely.
Yeah. So and that's some important thing, you know, for strong prognostic factors, you should incorporate them in your study and stratify for them. And by that way, you basically create sub-studies. Yeah. So let's say, imagine, for example, gender is an important prognostic factor for the indication you're looking into, then basically you create a study within male and another study within female. And of course, things should be, you know, generalizable and consistent. But in a sense, you have two studies. Yeah. So two twin studies in two different populations, the males and the females. So that's it. For me personally, I think it would make more sense to show the baseline characteristics by these different stratifications, because you're basically running sub-studies, yeah? And you want to see, you know, when males look different than females, what are all the differences between the males and the females? And that actually would require maybe some statistical tests, but not between randomized treatment groups. Yeah. You know, the other thing is you'll only check for those that you have observed, not for those that you haven't observed. Yeah. So there is also in this publication by Stefan Kreuters, he speaks about, and we'll put that in the show notes as usual, that even, you know, people then fish for the covariates they adjust for through that. And that makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah. Because then you actually make things worse. Like, shown in lots of literature, but
but this brings me to another point. Is really, I mean, if you have your observed or your plan for covariates, then you include them in the analysis. So there's, again, this is not, you know, it's no need for bringing in any comparison at baseline.
It's for prognostic factors that you know upfront, you should plan pre-specified subgroup analysis. And then you can include, okay, for this covariate, I know from this literature, and it's really good to include that in the protocol, where that kind of is coming from and what you expect in terms of the trends to see, you know, whether you see, you expect that females do better than males or whatsoever. It's really important to have that pre-specified in the beginning, and then you can get over it. So, in terms of the literature that we just discussed, so the most recent one is called Baseline Comparisons and Covariate Fishing, Bad Statistical Habits We Should Have Broken Yesterday. Could have been also a really nice title of this podcast episode, by the way. Yeah. I don't know. I think what it needs is for statisticians to be more bold and withstand the request. Yeah. And it's about taking leadership here. It's about standing your ground and saying, this doesn't make sense. And if we do that, it, for those who actually know that it's stupid, we look stupid and we don't want to look stupid. So that's could be also a nice argument against it.
Mm-hmm, it is. But actually, if you say, I mean, we said that it's illogical, or at least it's nonsense, it doesn't make sense. But is it then wrong to do the baseline testing? So does it do any harm?
I think it's misleading. it creates discussions where you then have, you know, nonsense discussions. Then you have discussions about, but here, by chance, there is something significantly different. Yeah, and then you can say, yeah, and by chance, something else will be significantly different, but in the other direction. Maybe we just haven't checked for that. Yeah, but, or we haven't collected that. So, and our overall statistical tests in the end take that into account. You know, they are designed that way.
And actually there's some comparisons as well that you see that it's even a higher percentage of, you know, of random significance that you can observe when checking with the, when you would repeat this on in an iterated way, and you look into into the publication. So there's a lot of significance that you will see, that is just by chance. And actually higher than you would expect this to be.
Yeah, and then you need to waste space in your manuscript or report to discuss it. And, you know, that just confuses people. And it just adds noise to the overall message of the clinical trial. And for me personally, if I see something like that, I think, well, then I can't trust the other statistical things in there.
Yeah, that's true.
If that statistician doesn't know that that's nonsense, what else doesn't he know? Or she know? Yeah. So I think it puts a lot of mistrust on such a study.
And this is usually shown at the beginning of the discussion. So you have the full time of discussing the results being in the spot.
Yeah. And probably there's lots of other things in your studies that are much more worthwhile to discuss about. Another kind of really, really good argument against it is, you know, the papers that we looked into by Doug Altman. Doug Altman is, for those who don't know him, he's not an unknown person. He is probably one of the most influential statisticians on evidence-based medicine of the last decades. For those who don't know it, he's the first author of the consort statement. And that is the statement, the checklist that everybody should use for decades on how to publish randomized clinical trials. It should be in every medical writing basic course. It should actually be also in every stats training. Still, I know that lots of statisticians never have heard about the consort statement, but it's really absolutely foundational in terms of reporting on clinical trials. Maybe it's that old that people think, well, everybody should know it by now, but like it is, you know, if you have just studied now, that paper is already more than 30 years old, so maybe you see it as not relevant anymore, but I think it's as relevant today as it was when it was published.
Yes, and also like sometimes, especially when you look at the statistician working at the CROs, you don't get too many publications as you would do usually when you work at the pharma side. So that's why you don't come across this that easily to the topic itself and the consort statements or the consort guideline for publication. Yeah. However, yes, I came across it actually this year at the PSI conference. There were some discussions around the consort.
Yeah. And the consort statements is something that you can really nicely use, especially with comments from journals, because that's something that they respect. And there it's written, and now I'm quoting, "Unfortunately, significant tests of baseline differences are still common. They were reported in half of 50 RCT trials published in leading journals in 1997. Such significance tests assess the probability that observed baseline differences could have occurred by chance. However, we already know that any differences are caused by chance. Tests of baseline difference are not necessarily wrong, just illogical." Okay, exactly.
It's basically summarizing what we just said.
So, you know, I think with Sis, we have given you a couple of really, really good citations to get into any discussions with your teams, with whoever wants to see these studies, these p-values, and push back on them. It really stand your ground, push back on them, and say, you don't want to look, you don't want to look stupid. Your study team doesn't want to look stupid. Just push back. And I hope with these literature by really giants within statistics, use them, cite them, and if people then don't listen, I don't know. Yeah, then you really need to work on your influencing skills. Yeah. So that was today a little bit of a short episode, but it's about a topic that I see very, very often. I see it, you know, some companies even have these p-values in their default baseline tables, which I think is quite odd. If your company does that, maybe it's time to change that.
Okay. Absolutely.
And if your sponsor asks for it because you're working for a CRO, maybe you can also improve the reputation of your sponsor by giving them a little bit of a hint of, well, they don't want to look stupid either, maybe.
Absolutely. All right.
Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background. And thank you, as always, for listening. Please tell others about this podcast if you enjoy it, so others can benefit from it as well. You can just share the effectivestatistician.com homepage, because there everybody finds all the show notes, and you can learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. If you haven't done yet, join the LinkedIn group and share your experiences, and also tell your colleagues about it. So, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.